Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. My name's Amy Parkin. So I just a little background. I'm new to Salt Lake City and new to Sunstone. I've never presented here before, so my first go round. My background is in literary studies. I've got an MA and did PhD work in English. So I'm coming at this topic today with that background, but not as a scholar. No more scholarship for me. This is Caroline Klein. For those of you who don't know her, she's doing a PhD in religious studies and women, right, at Claremont Graduate University. And a familiar face, Margaret Toscano, who's been at Sunstone before. A few times, right?
A few times.
So I'm going to go ahead and start us off today. My paper is essentially looking at, I'll start off with some of the conventions of the genre of popular romance, so that I can kind of verse those of you unfamiliar with it a little bit in that background. And then I'm specifically interested in looking at male constructs in romance novels, and then in Mormon culture. So I'll end talking a little bit about them in a Mormon context. So let me begin by saying that I left academia a year and a half ago, and I have not looked back. So I'm speaking today not as an academic and not as a scholar, though my background in the hallowed halls of the Ivory Tower will certainly inform my opinion. Instead, I'm speaking as a consumer of and participant in various cultures: American culture, Mormon culture, the culture of love, romance, and the battle of sexes. And the battle of the sexes is a very appropriate term to be used when discussing popular romance novels for a variety of reasons, some of which I'll delve into later. But first, I want to give you a little bit of background. While I'm convinced that some of the people sitting in this room have read their share of romance novels, I'm sure others of you have not, or at least you think you have not. First, why am I sure there are romance readers here? Because 1 in 5 Americans has read a romance novel. Because 25% of the books sold in the US are popular romance novels. And 55% of mass market fiction are popular romance novels. So essentially, as one commentator has put it, popular romance is the backbone of American publishing. I mean, it's just everywhere. You can't avoid it. That's a pretty amazing statistic when you think about it. 25% of all books published in the U.S. and more than half of mass market fiction. Beyond that, I would argue that all of you have probably read a romance at some point, because you've probably read something by Jane Austen, one of the Brontes, Samuel Richardson, Thomas Hardy, a few others, Fanny Burney, Elizabeth Gaskell. All of these classic kind of great works are at the root of the current trends in popular romance. In spite of its popularity, romance is the ugly stepdaughter of the book lover's library. I'm sure you've all seen the indicators of its lowly status. The reader who has opened the book so far on her lap that you're not going to be able to catch a glimpse of the ripped bodice, the man titty, which is an official term, the passionate embrace complete with the look of nauseated stupor on the face. You might have seen...
It's up there now, Amy.
Oh, there you go. You might have seen buyers passing their books to a cashier face down so that the garish colors and ridiculous titles like Mastered by Love or The Edge of Desire, don't show. The camouflage magazine held up behind the book to disguise what's being read. The e-reader is the boon of the romance reader's existence. No more embarrassment generated by the racy cover, the over-the-top title. No more knowing that the people who glimpse that passionate, lovemaking, semi-nude embrace will jump to all sorts of conclusions about your intelligence, your seriousness, your ability to live in reality, your capacity to have quote-unquote healthy relationships. Because these are the kinds of conclusions often reached about readers of romance. Indeed, in a recent article on the church's own KSL website, LDS life coach Kimberly Giles Sayer Giles, compared women's consumption of romance novels to men's consumption of pornography, opining, quote, "Women are more stimulated by romance than sex, so when they read romantic stories, and they don't have to be explicit to work, they can experience the same addicting chemical release as men do. For many women, these romance novels may be more than a necessity. They may be an addiction," end quote. She went on to assert that while many women don't see their consumption of romance novels as a problem, others, quote, "are admitting dissatisfaction in their marriages that may stem from reading these books," end quote. asserting that this addiction and the dissatisfaction it causes can lead to adultery. As you can expect, this didn't go over well in the romance world, which is popularly known as Romancelandia. Implicit in these and other critiques of the romance genre is the notion that their female readers cannot distinguish fiction and fantasy from reality, that they fall in love with unrealistic fictional heroes so fully that they ignore their real-life relationships and their wider social world, that they are so weak-willed and lacking in integrity that these fantasies in print can lead to adultery and sexual sin, and on and on and on. These are not new complaints. The modern novel as we know it first became a dominant literary form in the 18th century. According to Patricia Spax, in her book Novel Beginnings, Experiments in 18th Century English Fiction, the 18th century novel was a, quote, dubiously respectable literary form, perhaps partly because women wrote and read so many of them. Moralists insisted on fiction's power to corrupt, end quote. She continues to explain that the, quote, novelist genre did not quickly achieve respectability, linked in many minds to the romances that supplied a conventional staple of female reading. Novels were feared by moralists as possible stimuli to erotic fantasy and domestic idleness, end quote. As you can see from very early on, novels' illicit content and ability to engage the imagination were perceived as threats to women's moral rectitude and domestic responsibility. And the work of female authors was often dismissed as unworthy, sometimes on very simple sexist bases, other times because 18th and 19th century female authors, more often than their male counterparts, relied upon writing in order to support themselves financially. The mercenary aspect of their efforts tainted their product in the eyes of male authors of quote-unquote artistic fiction, many of whom, especially in the 18th century, had other forms of income. In 19th century America, about the same time that it became horrified by Mormons' prurient marriage practices, many women found unprecedented success with their writing. They were selling tens and even hundreds of thousands of copies of their books. The most prominent of these, of course, today is Louisa May Alcott, who wrote in a huge variety of genres. We know her best for domestic fiction, but she also wrote quite salacious gothic fiction, which definitely belong in the tradition of romance. This upset Nathaniel Hawthorne to such an extent that he complained to his publisher that, quote, America is now wholly given over to a damned mob of scribbling women, and I should have no chance of success while the public taste is occupied with their trash, and should be ashamed of myself should I succeed, end quote. I imagine he would be rather horrified were I to draw parallels between his Scarlet Letter and popular romance, so I won't. I wouldn't want the poor deer to turn over in his grave. In 20th century America, novels with explicit sexual content have been regularly censored and banned. It's no surprise that we continue to hear the fear-mongering complaints, like those published on KSL website, about the morally corruptive power of these novels, which are so often written by women, for women, about women, novels which explicitly represent women's sexuality, desire, and pleasure, as well as their power. Because at the end of the day, many romance novels are about just that, power. Sexual power, social power, emotional power, and, in my opinion, and something I'll explore a little later, the autonomy and self-realization as a form of power. Of course, what would a romance be without a hero? I'd like to focus the remainder of my comments on the romantic hero, and on the insights he provides into gender constructs more generally, and then more specifically into Mormon constructions of male gender roles and stereotypes. So to begin, I want to give you a little bit of a primer on the character of the romantic hero. And to give you a visual, we'll pull this back up for a moment. As you may or may not be aware, for a while, romantic heroes were not all that desirable, to be perfectly frank. For instance, The Flame and the Flower, Kathleen Woodowis's novel that gave rise to the quote-unquote bodice ripper genre. And bodice ripper is a term that refers to a certain kind of historical romance novel, very common in the 70s and 80s. So it's not any romance novel. Just that was a misconception I had, which was recently cleared up by a friend. So anyways, the Flame and the Flower was published in 72, and it's kind of seen as the kickoff to contemporary popular romance novels that had much more explicit sexual content than their older predecessors. So in this novel, the hero, Brandon Birmingham, a 35-year-old American, British, pirate type of guy. rapes the 17-year-old. Don't forget that. Rapes the 17-year-old heroine, Heather Simmons, on their first encounter. Now, I suppose he might be excused because he thought she was a prostitute. But in our enlightened society, even prostitutes have a right not to be raped. This paragon of manly power does reclaim some of his integrity when he marries her after discovering that she was pregnant. Of course, he had to be compelled to marry her by a magistrate. So, not sure how much integrity was there. No matter how much mental gymnastics we're willing to do in order to excuse Brandon's initial mistake, it's more than a slight stretch of the imagination to believe that a woman would fall in love with her rapist. But in the 70s and 80s, especially in bodice rippers, romance heroines fall in love with their abusive heroes regularly, in spite of being imprisoned, kidnapped, tied up, and of course raped, repeatedly, even by men who are their and their families' sworn enemies. For instance, in Brenda Joyce's The Conqueror, the marauding hero Rolf of Warren, who's one of the Norman conquerors who invades Saxon England, Saxon Britain, he first defeats the heroine's brothers in battle. He then becomes engaged to her legitimate sister. She's an illegitimate half-sister, who's also thought of as a witch. And then he rapes her, repeatedly. And Joyce, unlike Woodwiss, actually uses the word rape. No pansy-ass sugarcoating for Rolf of Warren. He sees what he wants, and he takes it. It is heroes like Woodwiss's Brandon Birmingham or Joyce's Rolf of Warren that had many feminists dismissing popular romance right alongside elitist appreciators of real literature, capital R, capital L. The power discrepancies between such novels' heroes and heroines was enormous, and not just by virtue of their violent, both sexually and non-sexually, content. It's not unusual for the hero to be much older than the heroine. Brandon, again, is 35, Heather is 17. The hero almost always, if not actually always, has enormous wealth, political power, and physical prowess. I've encountered a chubby romance heroine or two. I have yet to meet a hero with love handles. And these novels almost invariably end in traditional monogamous marriage, followed quickly by babies. It seems clear that such novels would be anathema to feminists, especially so to Mormon feminists, who spend so much energy pushing back against inscribing women into a very traditional social structure, which is generally replicated in some fashion in romance novels. So what is it that has a feminist like me reading popular romance? Why is it that I find them a fascinating and revelatory representation of gender constructs and not just in a negative fashion? Because I do. Popular romance are my go-to in-flight entertainment, and I fly a lot. They're what I read when I go to bed and want to unwind for half an hour before sleeping, unless it's Mariah Jovan's most recent novel, Magdalene, which kept me awake till 5 in the morning. And I find their representations of gender and relationships hopeful. A large part of this has to do with the fact that I read more recent romances than the bodice rippers, so popular in the 70s and 80s. So I'll give you a little bit of background on these newer, more modern romantic heroes. The authors of a book called Beyond Heaving Bosoms, The Smart Bitches Guide to Romance Novels. These women started a website called Smart Bitches Trashy Novels, or Trashy Books. It's a fabulous, fabulous website.
What is it called?
It's called Smart Bitches Trashy Books. So in their book, they explain that the, quote, modern hero has to earn his happy ending, and he has to earn it by growing with the heroine and adapting and sharing her worldview, end quote. This modern hero, quote, must face at the very least some kind of journey and resolution alongside the heroine, and thus demonstrate his own worth, end quote. Where his bodice-ripping counterpart is desirable and worth loving simply by virtue of his being, the modern romantic hero is worth loving by virtue of his becoming. There remain power discrepancies between these modern romantic heroes and their heroines, sometimes of class, often of money, frequently, if not always, of sexual experience. But the hero is rarely as static as those of older romances. Where the older romances generally focus on the heroine's developmental arc, more recent romances portray the complementary development of both hero and heroine. I'm not much of a fan of older romances. Just put that out there. I like the more recent stuff. But I'd like to go back to those old, vicious, rapacious romantic heroes to make a point. And I want to talk about how romances deal with gender constructs and relationships between men and women. the extremity of the power imbalance in these novels, these older bodice-ripping novels with the vicious heroes, makes my point a little easier to see. As I asserted earlier, romance novels are about power. They're about sexual power, about social power, about emotional power. They belonged, the heroes of these older romances belong to the powerful classes in their society, whether historical or contemporary. It's very interesting to see how in historical romances, almost invariably, the heroes are members of the upper class. Their nobility, their gentility, they're somewhere in the upper echelons of society. It's very interesting to watch how that gets translated to contemporary romances set in 20th century America. Think athletes, think FBI guys, think really, really rich entrepreneurs. So these men govern literally or by virtue of their enormous wealth, their worlds. They wield inexplicable emotional control over the heroines who find themselves drawn to these bad boys in spite of their bad behavior, and they are rapacious in both senses of that word in their sexual appetites. But the heroine also possesses power. In spite of her apparent social limitations, either by virtue of social class or simply tighter social restrictions and her sexual inexperience. What is that power? Wendell and Tan, the authors of the Smart Bitches site and book, refer to it as the power of the magic hoo-hoo, another technical term. They're only partially joking. In romance novels, the sex between the hero and the heroine does possess enormous transformative power. Naturally would for the virgin heroine, but it also does for the sexually experienced hero, who once he has sex with the heroine, finds himself unable to derive any sexual pleasure from, or even feel any sexual attraction to, any other woman. It would be easy to dismiss this as a completely unrealistic glorification of sex, combined with the notion that there is a quote-unquote one love to be found, a la Saturday's Warrior. It is those things, but it's more than that, too. The act of deflowering the virgin is just what it seems. It's an act of claiming, it's an act of possessing, it's an initiation into sexual experience. But it's also an introduction of the heroine into the hero's world of power and pleasure. He may be laying claim to her, to put it in somewhat primitive terms, but he's not simply taking her virginity. He is giving her pleasure, always. In other words, she is not simply functioning as an object to be claimed and owned from that point forward, she is being accepted as a partner, unequal, someone worthy of and with a right to sexual pleasure. And her equality does not stop there. Because no matter how experienced the hero, this will be a first for him too. A first in terms of emotional connection and vulnerability. He usually doesn't recognize that vulnerability right at first. So he'll continue being his normal, as the smart bitches put it, elf hole. Half alpha, half asshole self. But eventually he comes to a moment of realization. And that realization is that this woman holds him in her power because he needs her in a way he has never needed anyone else. The double developmental arcs of more recent romances illustrate this point a little more clearly, because the heroine exerts influence in ways other than by virtue of popping the hero's emotional cherry. For instance, in Madeline Hunter's The Protector, the heroine Anna de Leon literally saves the hero's life, not once, but twice. First from the Black Death, which Morbin acquires from a dying squire he nurses, then from being hanged by the villain of the piece, who, of course, wants to rape Anna. In fact, the villain in that particular novel looks a whole hell of a lot like the heroes of the Bodice Rippers in 1970s and 80s novels. This example also shows the more sensitive nature of the quote-unquote modern romantic hero, who cares enough for others that he'll nurse a dying boy, though he's not sensitive enough to tolerate his wife's more irregular habits, like dressing like a man and riding out with her guard to defend the castle. Of course, Morbin's development also requires that he learn to come to grips with Anna's unconventional character, which is, after all, why he fell in love with her in the first place. Over the course of the novel, Anna and Morbin negotiate, finding a balance of power that respects both of them and their unique strengths. So I don't want to take all of my colleagues' time, so I'm going to skip forward just a little bit and ask the question, what does this have to do with Mormonism and conceptions of gender? Several years ago when I first read Betty Friedan's Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique, which was a really powerful, emotionally powerful experience for me as a Mormon woman, there were just a lot of reverberations in that book. I started with her new essay for a more recent edition, in which she asserts, as we approach a new century and a new millennium, it's the men who have to break through to a new way of thinking about themselves in society. So she's essentially arguing that women's progress is kind of stalled until we start thinking more creatively about male gender roles. So you can see this if you look around in our society now. There are men who are threatened by women who have achieved great things and gained ground in education and professional pursuits and earning capacity. There have been calls for a rebirth of traditional masculinity. Just last month in the New York Times, Erica Jong bemoaned the death of sexual passion in her daughter's generation and the resurgence of 1950s gender roles. So one response to this feeling like male gender roles need to be reconstructed has been to reclaim the very old, very traditional senses of masculine power and masculine, what is appropriate masculine sphere and female spheres. At the Exponent blog, where Caroline and I are both permas, we spent a month or two last year fending off the rather extremist views of LDS anarchists, who subscribe to rather twisted perceptions of gender built squarely on the foundations of the church's patriarchal heritage. Part of what motivated these men was the conviction that understandings of sex and gender have become confused. At the Mormon Men blog, the anonymous author writes, or rants, at length about recapturing masculinity, by which he means a version of alphas, due to their thoughtlessly domineering behavior, their arrogant presumption of privilege, their right to have access to their women in any way at any time. I mean, it's really disturbing to read this guy's writing and know that he's writing today and he's taking these kinds of attitudes. There are other more moderate versions of these blogs. For instance, a new player on the blogger-nacle scene called Modern Mormon Men sets out to explore the definitions of each of those three words. What does it mean to be modern, to be Mormon, to be men? Recently, Doves and Servants ran a week-long series on the question of masculinity, and many of us have written individual posts on this question. So as I pointed out in a post I wrote at Exponent, it's not enough for us to identify what men should not, and if my experience is any way indicative, do not want to be. We, and by we I mean both men and women, need to develop a positive image of what a progressive, enlightened, post-gender man is. It's not enough to want to get rid of machismo and entitlement and patriarchy. We need to have some sense of what will take their place. Perhaps most importantly, we need a society in which individuals make choices for themselves about what works best for themselves in their own individual circumstances. And this is where that question of autonomy and self-realization comes back into my argument. So I've said at the beginning that romance is about power, sexual, social, and emotional, but it's also about autonomy and self-realization as a form of power. What makes romance heroes and heroines both powerful is that they're able to escape the confines of socially imposed gender constructs by virtue of seeing each other, recognizing each other for the individuals, the complex individuals that they are. So I want to wrap up by talking a little bit about some of the male characters in Mariah Jovan's novels. She has a series of three novels. She's a practicing Mormon. The first novel is called The Proviso, and then I'm totally blanking on the middle novel's name.
How do you spell her last name, maybe?
Jovan is J-O-V-A-N. I'm most interested in talking about The Proviso and Magdalene, so I'll stick with those two. Magdalene is the most recent. So in The Proviso, we meet a group of Mormon men and one woman, and they're an interesting bunch. First, we have Sebastian, who is a famous artist and financial whiz, and he has problems. So each one of them have problems that come from their particular versions of Mormon masculinity. So in Sebastian's case, he is not so sold on the atonement. He doesn't understand a God who would require a blood sacrifice of one of his own children, who would make his children go to earth, stumble around, and say, you can't come back because you're not perfect. You can only come back after somebody else performs a blood sacrifice. Where Sebastian kind of breaks free from Mormon constructs is he is the nurturer in his family. He's the one who can't stand to be away from his children, who's constantly there, present, taking care of his children. So we have Sebastian, we have I should have written down all their names. I know these novels inside and out, and I've forgotten them. Sebastian's cousin, who is a lawyer and takes righteous justice into his own hands. When he loses a trial against a serial killer, he goes out and performs vigilante justice. And as a result, is excommunicated. You know, excommunication for murder makes sense. But in his kind of understanding of justice, what's morally right and wrong, this man steps outside of approved roles, right, both in terms of his job as a district attorney and in terms of his Mormon beliefs, and takes matters into his own hands. And finally, and most interesting, is I'm so embarrassed that I'm forgetting all their names. The third male character, who is a returned missionary, who is married, who is on fast track to leadership, but the conflict for him has to do with resolving his enormous sex drive, which trends towards quote-unquote nasty, as Jovan puts it. He likes bondage, he likes power play in his sex, and he has a hard time reconciling that with what he's been taught through vehicles like the miracle of forgiveness, right? Through images of appropriate Mormon masculinity. And when you stop and think about what appropriate Mormon masculinity is, I mean, it's inscribed into our scriptures, right? That it has to be persuasion, it has to be gentleness and kindness, right? It's not strength, it's not passion, it's certainly not sexual. So, Bryce, thank you, that just came back. So what Bryce deals with is this kind of internal struggle between what he knows himself to be and what the church is dictating to him he should be. And even as he's living the life that he should be living, his wife ends up cheating on him. So he's trying to do what he's supposed to do, and it ends up falling apart. Now, that's something I've certainly experienced, so I can relate to that. But what's interesting to me about these male characters is that they find themselves trapped inside of socially constructed gender roles, just as women in the historical romances that are so popular do. They're very confined, and they have to find some way to break out. And each one of them breaks out by way of relationship with the right woman. And that, for me, is the crux of what makes romance novels very feminist in their approach, and very enlightening about relationships and gender, is that instead of focusing just on, oh, but she's been victimized, or oh, but she has no governing power or no financial power, what they instead focus on is self-realization. Right, the opportunity of each individual to become true to him or herself, whether we're talking about the male individual or the female individual. So I'm going to wrap up there because I've hit my time limit, but we'll try to have a few minutes at the end for questions. So, Caroline?
So I wanted to focus on, rather than the literature, I wanted to look at actual Mormon romance novel readers themselves, and as it turned out, in the survey I conducted, 95% of the women that responded to me were feminist, and so you're going to get Mormon feminist romance novel readers' responses. So for some years now, I've been fascinated by the fact that in nearly every ward I've lived in, there is a group of women who regularly read romance novels. Not the Deseret Books type of romance novel. I'm talking the real thing. I'm talking the bodice rippers containing explicit sex. These are women who often hold visible positions in the ward and cleave to Mormon culture in other ways, but they do love their juicy romance novels. This fascinated me because... one second. Sorry. Because church rhetoric has been kind of negative. Sorry, this isn't like full screen here. About romance novels. They have conflated it with pornography, as you can kind of see.
Oh, that didn't work. Here, let me do it, Caroline.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, if you can fool around with that, that'd be awesome. As you can see in this first quote, romance novels are included in church leaders' definitions of pornography. And then if you go, and if that is the equation, romance novels equals pornography, and you see how they're talking about pornography, you can see how dire the predictions are about people's lives and relationships if they are partaking of this stuff. They warn that it's going, like I mentioned, they warn that it might lead to adultery. They warn that it might lead to abnormal, illegal, or inappropriate desires. They warn that it'll lead you to treat your spouse badly because the spouse cannot measure up to the fantasy projected on the screen or page. However, such warnings don't seem to overly impact these romance-reading church ladies who continue swapping their books. I wonder why. Why do they not see these books as dangerous? Do these dire predictions just not apply in these women's minds to the reading of these novels? I've been toying with the idea that indeed these predictions do not apply as often to these romance-reading women. And let me throw out a few reasons why. I think that perhaps romance novels are not leading very often to the breakdown of lives and relationships for Mormon women. First of all, Amy, how did you
put here,
this?
Thank you.
You want me to go to the next page?
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. So here are three reasons why I thought this stuff did not hold true so much. First of all, romance novels are extremely affirming of marriage, wifehood, motherhood, and thus rather than turning women away from their mates if they happen to be married, they might encourage women to nurture the relationship. And unlike visual porn, the sex on the page is usually in the context of a committed or soon-to-be-committed relationship. So bottom line, romance novels affirm marriage. Secondly, let's face it, a lot of these books are titillating. Romance novels might make women more sexually interested in their husbands, which actually ends up benefiting the relationship, particularly if we take seriously the idea that men and women's sex drives are different. And thirdly, romance novels, and this is a lot of what Amy was talking about, affirm female desire in all aspects of life. They affirm a woman achieving her dreams about a fulfilling relationship, but they also often, at least the more recent ones, affirm other dreams about how she wants to contribute to her world. And so they don't have this corrosive effect on women's sense of selves. Rather, they can actually be kind of empowering. That said, I do fully acknowledge that there are reasons to worry about the messages that are sometimes projected in romance novels. That fulfillment is always found in marriage, that men are sexually aggressive and controlling, that the sexes seem incapable of good communication until the end of the book. These are all things to question. I think it's important to keep these in mind as we discuss Mormon women in romance novels and the reasons why some women ultimately choose to turn away from the genre. In thinking about these questions, I decided to go to the source to ask Mormon women romance novel readers why they read and how they saw these novels affecting their relationships and their own spirituality. I had 40 romance-reading Mormon women take my survey, and as I mentioned, the vast majority of them were feminists. 95% of them define themselves as feminists to some degree, and so I think you need to definitely keep that in mind when I share some of these responses. But before I begin with my Mormon women romance readers, I think it'll be enlightening to have some sense of the academic work done on romance novels. As Amy mentioned, early academic studies of the genre, particularly in the 1970s, were largely quite critical. They called the books dope for dupes. They noted how passive the heroines were, how personality-less they were, the large power differential between the men and women, how the women always ended up entrenched in this patriarchal marital system, and ultimately how the very desire for romance itself stood in conflict with feminist values of self-assertion and independence. That was kind of the 1970s approach. However, in the 1980s, a scholar named Janice Radway, and this is my next little slide, thank you, did a hugely influential study of romance novel readers. What she did is these in-depth interviews with a group of romance-reading women in the Midwest. And unlike previous academics who found nothing redeeming in these books, Radway insisted that you had to look at the consumers themselves, not just the literature. What effect did it have on these consumers? What did they get from these books? And she found that there were actually some somewhat liberating aspects to engaging in this hobby, even as the books simultaneously perpetuated patriarchal attitudes and structures. For instance, she found that the actual act of reading the novels was an act of resistance to some degree. To read a romance, and to read it at the rate these women were reading them several a week, the women were saying to their husbands and their kids, and whatever else was pulling at them, they were saying, no, I need an escape, I need to retreat from you all, I need this time in my cave to read my book. And it actually turned out to be an act of self-assertion for them to say that I am important enough that I deserve to go away and read my book right now. Another thing she found going on with these readers, reading romance was actually a coping mechanism for marital relationships that were not as fulfilling as they would like. These women were often not being attended in real life, and so they turned to this fantasy world where women were loved and attended. And so going along with that idea, I thought this was very interesting. These novels taught these women reinterpreting skills. So what they would do is, in the books, often the hero is kind of cold and cruel initially, but underneath, the heroine finds out that the hero loved her all the time. Well, what the women do is they say, my husband's being a jerk to me. But because they've read these romance novels, they can kind of reinterpret their husband's behavior and say, yes, he's being mean, he's not being loving, but I know he loves me underneath it all, you know, just like these romance heroes. And so there's this way that the novels were interacting with the way they approached their own relationships. So this is a really influential work, and the reason I talked about it briefly is because I wanted to see if any of these dynamics were going on with Mormon women romance novel readers. And so let's go to the next slide. The first thing I wanted to talk about was the effect on relationships according to the survey I did. And for the rest of the paper, I'm going to have Margaret and Amy kind of chime in a reader's theater as they read out quotes from these women who took my survey. First, I want to look at how romance novels affect relationships. I chose to look at this because of the GA's dire predictions about the death of relationships when one partner starts using pornography. I also look at it because much of Radway's work dealt with how romance reading affected the women's relationships. So the first point of contrast, Radway's women read to escape from lives and relationships that were not always that satisfactory. The Mormon women I surveyed also cited escape. About 50% of them said that they read to escape. However, that sense of escape was not really tied to dissatisfaction with their marriages. Rather, the women were overwhelmingly positive about how wonderful their husbands were.
My husband is better than any fictional hero. He embodies the best in men. He works two jobs, a total of 80 hours a week, to take care of his family. He doesn't complain and doesn't resent anything he has to do. He is all that a man should be. I am his partner and he is mine. We share duties, responsibilities, and are considerate of each other's needs. He tells me all the time how much he values me and our family and our relationship. Our sex life is amazing.
So that's one interesting contrast. Another interesting contrast centered around marriage and relationships. While Radway's women's relationships were benefited because the genre taught them to give their husbands the benefit of the doubt when they were being jerks, the Mormon feminist women's relationships in my survey were benefited largely in a sexual way. 54% of the women interviewed said that their relationships were strengthened because they were more sexually interested in their men when reading the novels. And 40% also said that reading romance novels made their sex life more exciting and fulfilling in general. And so only a quarter of my women that I surveyed said there was no benefit at all sexually to reading romance novels. And I thought that was telling. 75% of these women said that there was a sexual benefit in their relationships to reading. And I love that because the women were saying, from what I could tell, that their sex lives were important, their sexual fulfillment was, you know, an important aspect of their lives, it was a benefit to them and to their relationships, that their sex lives were enhanced by reading these books. Their enjoyment and interest in sex was a motivation for reading. And so I saw in this like a lot of, this was self-assertion. I mean, this to me was real self-assertion about what women wanted in their lives. Quote number two.
Okay. Explicit romance novels are helpful in getting me into a mind frame where I'm interested in sex, when otherwise the duties of being a working woman, mother to a toddler, or even just plain hormones make me uninterested in sex. Thinking about sex helps get me in the mood. It was pretty much the only way I could have any interest after my son was born until my hormones normalized. And my husband is just as good in bed, or better, than any man I've read about in a book.
Other than getting caught up in my book, where I would rather read, they have no negative effect on my relationship. If anything, they do make me think more about sex as a healthy expression of married or romantic love. I think they've made me a bit more creative as a lover.
There is currently no Viagra for a woman who feels low sex drive. In general, male biology is different, and his brain thinks of sex/women often, whereas a woman does not. I am somewhat certain that reading romance novels of any sort, including PG ones, in the past has helped increase my openness to intimacy with my husband.
Reading romance novels does wonders for my libido, and my husband is thrilled. He is very supportive of a bodice ripper if he thinks he will get something out of it.
So these are very indicative of the kinds of responses I got when I asked about the benefits to romance novel reading. Let's see. These women I quoted have seen their marriages benefit from more and better sex because of their consumption of these books. And these voices you've just heard reflect the majority of sentiment about the effect on relationships. But I also wanted to focus a little bit on some voices of women who actually are not in relationships at the moment.
I'm not married, and I'm currently not in a relationship. So it's more like, quote, yes, I'm more interested in sex when I'm reading a romance novel, end quote, which can be frustrating, but which also pushes me to put myself out there and take the chances necessary to find a partner.
And I thought that was interesting because, while she doesn't benefit sexually from reading the romance novels, she does benefit from being inspired to get out of her comfort zone and go meet people. Interestingly, a different woman had a totally different response to romance novels. After years of consuming them herself and watching her single friends consume them, she decided that they were not having a positive effect on her. Rather than inspiring her to get out there and be social, they were actually leading her to be more passive.
I realized that because of what I read in romance novels, I genuinely expected men to be aggressive, if not sexually, then in their pursuit of me. I noticed that I had dated more non-members because they tended to be more open about pursuit, which led to other problems when they wanted more than I was generally willing to give. And in dating these more aggressive men, I glanced over men that I could have had a better relationship with.
And so to get in another contrasting voice here, I want this next quote is going to feature the perspective of one of our few women who found that romance novels actually had a negative impact on her relationship.
Sex proved to be a big challenge for us. It took a good year before we were both enjoying ourselves. The romance novels gave me unrealistic expectations. In real life, it took hard work to achieve an orgasm. Giving them up has proved to make it easier for us to work. She means the romance novels, not orgasms. Giving them up has proved to make it easier for us to work together to have a great sex life. Plus, as my husband pointed out, they were getting me as aroused as visual porn was getting him aroused. Since I didn't like his, it was only fair I give up mine.
And speaking of that arousing, titillating component of romance novels, 55% of the women saw romance novels as pornography to some extent. And so that was interesting because they were acknowledging the sexual aspect to reading these books, but 55% of them acknowledging they were pornography to some extent. In terms of, so some of the GA rhetoric is about how pornography hurts relationships, but it's also about how it hurts the spirit and the psyche. And so I wanted to also ask these women, does romance novel reading hurt your spirit, your spirituality, your connection with God? Does it hurt your own psychological well-being? And 80% of these women did not see the novels hurting them in any way, like hurting them personally. And I think that perhaps this is because, in a true Mormon sense, you know, by their fruits you shall know them. They just, they lived their lives, they didn't see the negative effect from it. So let me turn to the effect on the selves. So this is the second part of it. Let's go to, I'm trying to skip over here because I want to get to Margaret really fast. Let's go to quote number 9. Who has that?
Margaret, I think you do.
Oh, yeah. This is, okay.
Oh, no,
this is
I do.
Great.
I'm sorry.
This is like a Mormon feminist who truly finds these novels empowering. So listen to her. Number 9.
Okay. What I get out of romance novels. 1, that women are capable of great feats of daring do and adventure. 2, that women are strong, fearless, and so actually badass there was only one man who could match her. That women who are in positions of oppression can and ought to do whatever they have to do to survive. 4, that women need not be ashamed of their sexual desires.
Besides benefiting sexually from romance novels, I find myself being more independent, more willing to take risks, and more satisfied with myself as a person from reading these novels.
So other women didn't focus so much on the empowerment aspect, but they do mention their spirituality and the inability or ability of romance novels to harm their relationship with God.
My creator and I have a close relationship. Why would reading about couples who overcome obstacles to commit their lives to each other offend my connection with God?
I find romance novels strengthening, especially in terms of relating to a female divine.
So these are some reasons why the women didn't feel like their spirituality or their psyches were being harmed by the consumption of these books. They felt like there was an empowering quality to a lot of these novels, and they felt that sex was a healthy part of life and relationship, and that these books served as a helpful reminder of that. However, I think once again it's important to bring up some of the contrasting voices. A couple of women acknowledge some potential psychological or spiritual problems that can come about in conjunction with reading these books.
As a single adult Mormon, I think focusing too much on a desire to be in a relationship can cause feelings of bitterness towards the church and its restrictions on romance and courtship. It's easy to blame the church for being single, especially if one is not the, quote, Molly Mormon stay-at-home mom type. The church seems to promote as our type. The church seems to promote as the ideal. Romance novels can keep one's focus here, not because of the sex, but because of the relationships and the overall theme that everyone should be in one to be happy.
Great.
The only time I've felt that reading romance novels has been problematic for me is when I was depressed enough that they became my primary escape mechanism for avoiding everything. I do get absorbed in them, and it's hard to put them down sometimes. And when I add that to depression, it's just too easy to keep reading and reading and reading and not do what needs to be done because life is too painful. But I think this would be true of almost anything I use as an escape, whether we were talking about movies or video games or television or eating or drinking. So the problem, as I see it, was not romance novels, but depression. And romance novels were just something I latched on in order to escape.
Okay. I'm going to skip the rest of my thing and just go right to my conclusion. I also asked the women if reading romance novels leads to affairs, because that's part of the rhetoric from the church. And I just, without reading you any quotes, the resounding answer was no, absolutely not. Everything in the genre is about fidelity between two people. It does not have to do with affairs. And so they completely said no way. So in conclusion, just to sum up some of the points I've been making, why are Mormon feminist women reading romance novels? Because, maybe I didn't even make a last slide. First of all, Mormon women, Mormon feminist women, as well as a lot of women in the Western world, are drawn to stories about love and relationships. There's a mythic quality that taps into something in their psyches, and it just resonates. I also would not discount the fact that Mormonism's intense focus on the importance of marriage and family relationships might also contribute to Mormons' interest in the genre. It makes sense that Mormons on a primal level are attracted to stories that revolve around the idea that a healthy, satisfying marriage partnership is an important component of life. And secondly, there's actually often this sense of empowerment that comes from reading novels in which women are placed in difficult situations, and they use their wits and talents to navigate the world and find love and relationship. And finally, the most interesting thing I found in the study, because they don't see negative impacts, usually, coming from the consumption of these books, they actually see these positive benefits coming out, and it's a sexual benefit. That's the thing I found most exciting and interesting. They were willing to acknowledge the sexual benefits of reading romance novels. And I think this is in stark contrast to Radway's study, in which the relationship benefits centered around learning how to mentally deal with unsatisfactory husbands. The difference, and maybe I'm trying to think of why would this difference be? Why would my Mormon feminist women be talking about the sexual benefits, whereas 30 years ago, Radway's women in the Midwest didn't mention it? And it could be the difference of 30 years. It could be the fact that times have changed and people are just more open about private things than they used to be. But I also would like to think that it's because, like I said before, 95% of my women were feminist. And they seem to feel like they deserve to have a great sex life with their spouse. And they were willing to say that their sex lives matter, that their sexual fulfillment is a worthy goal. And if these books contributed to that and to the health of their marriage, then they didn't accept these negative pronouncements about romance novels being bad. So I'll end there so Margaret can take on.
It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm trying to see where I can stand and see everybody in this room.
That pole is really bad.
I can stand in front of the pole.
I'm one that likes to see my audience. So, oh, I think I did it right there. Okay. Again, it's a pleasure to be with you and be on this panel with Amy and Caroline. So, why would three smart women with advanced degrees in literary studies promote the value of reading romance novels? Isn't the romance genre an inferior type of literature that no one with sophisticated taste should read? And why would three outspoken feminists assert the value of the romance genre? Well, you've already heard some excellent answers to this, and I am going to overlap a little bit with some of the points that Amy and Caroline May, but I think that still a slightly different point of view here. So don't romance novels reinforce the worst gender stereotypes that feminists have fought against for years, namely traditional patriarchal marriage, female submission to dominant males, unrealistic views about male-female relationships, and essentialist views about gender. Our purpose today is not to persuade all of you to become romance readers, although I think after Caroline's presentation, we may have some converts, right? Like the arts in general, the Latin motto holds true, de gustibus non disputandum, concerning matters of taste you can't argue. I will confess right now, though, that I am a romantic at heart and I enjoy this genre, that is, when it is well written. Like any genre, there is an abundance of mediocrity, some excellence, and some truly deplorable writing. But evaluating the literary merits of the romance genre is not the purpose of our panel. Rather, we are using the question of why romance is so popular with women today, even among the very educated, and this is not just true with Mormon readers, but in general. All the surveys have showed this. And I think it's interesting, I hadn't seen any surveys of Mormon readers, but the fact that your research bears this out, I think, is really fascinating, Caroline. And not only are educated women readers, but they are the writers. There are a lot of women with PhDs who secretly write romance novels on the side, which is very interesting. So why would these educated women read and like and write romance? And we're using this to really address two larger feminist questions as they relate to Mormon women. Why in what is sometimes called a post-feminist age do women long for romantic love? Why do they still see their fulfillment in terms of love and marriage, often over career? And this is true with a lot of non-Mormon women, right? I guess I say that next. Even when they are non-Mormons who are not told to do so by church leaders. What does the fact that smart women read romances say about what women want? And I think as feminists, we should care about what women want. Number two, what does women's interest in romance novels reveal about gender roles today? Is it possible to go beyond male and female differences? Which, of course, a lot of the 1970 feminists wanted to. Should we want to? Does desire depend on difference? To me, that is a very important question. I, of course, cannot give complete answers to these complex questions in the time I have. Instead, I will suggest some ways to approach them by focusing on three aspects of this debate. I want to outline briefly for you the ongoing feminist interaction and debate surrounding romance literature. Second, I want to make a list of what I see as feminist values within the production, that is, the writing, publishing, and consuming of romance. Third, I want to explain why I think these questions are especially important for Mormon women. In this regard, I will have to address the question of the soft porn aspect of romance that Caroline has addressed. Is it appropriate for an LDS audience? And I guess I'm using my own reasons. I didn't do any surveys. I will begin with a brief overview of the feminist debate about the value of popular romance. We could start in the 1970s when a group of feminist protesters carried plaques outside the Manhattan offices of Avon Books in a reaction to a slew of best-selling bodice rippers published by Avon. And it's interesting, I mean, these were, when I'm talking about best-selling, they were selling millions of copies. It was huge, okay, in the 1970s. And one of these was Kathleen Woodiwiss's, the one that Amy mentioned, 1972, The Flame and the Flower, and Rosemary Rogers' 1974, Sweet Savage Love. Some have seen these books as the beginning of a modern romance genre itself. I was not at all interested in such books when they came out. I was reading great literature and Latin, right? But so I'm doing that tongue-in-cheek. So it was only recently that I read The Flame and the Flower as part of my academic study of this topic. I do such great research. Not only do I look at romance novels, but I look at Greek erotic vase paintings. That's another one of my topics of research. Who would know, right, that as a, you know, an academic, you could have so much fun. I have to
say, though, with the Flame in the Flower, I was not impressed. I wanted to throw both the hero and the heroine overboard the ship, carrying them to America within the first 100 pages of this very long novel, because they are possibly the two of the stupidest characters ever written. And I agree with Amy that the 70s, I didn't think this was the greatest time. I like the more recent ones, too. Nevertheless, the Avon Books' bodice rippers mark an important point in the history of women's writing, because they are in some ways an outgrowth of women's liberation, in spite of the feminist protest against them. These bodice rippers are one of the first public spaces. Women were secretly writing about this before, but this is one of the first public spaces where women could speak their sexual desire freely and openly. But is female desire to be trusted? Should we value any choice a woman makes? This is perhaps the central issue in the feminist debate. We Mormon feminists are well aware of the problem. If our sisters say they are perfectly happy in the present patriarchal structure of the LDS Church, if they say that they do not feel like second-class citizens, who are we to say they don't know what they are talking about? Should we impose our feminist values on them? And yet, the thrust, dare I use the term, of feminist critique against the romance genre is that it puts the female reader in bondage to stereotypical gender roles. Germaine Greer argued in 1970 in her book Female Eunuch that the traits of the romance genre, quote, have been invented by women cherishing the chains of their bondage. I'll read that again. That the traits of the romance genre have been invented by women cherishing the chains of their bondage. But neither the romance genre nor feminist critiques of it began in the 1970s. Some see the true beginning of the romance novel in Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice or Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, both literary masterpieces, although they took a time for them to get that status, to which contemporary women writers aspire. Others, like myself, think there are important prototypes of the genre in the ancient Greek and Roman romances, in ancient fairy tales and fairy tales in general, such as the Cupid and Psyche story, and in medieval popular romance. Proto-feminist critiques of romantic love also began in the Middle Ages with writers like Heloise, if any of you know of her, the famous lover of Peter Abelard, who lambasted him for ignoring her after he was castrated by her uncle for their illicit affair. Very good story, by the way. Though few and far between, other women from the medieval period to modern times, such as Mary Wollstonecraft, have wondered about the value of romantic love. In the 1930s and 1940s, Simone de Beauvoir and Karen Horney both worried that women's tendencies to overvalue romantic love and marriage lie at the root of their submission to patriarchal structures, reinforcing stereotypical gender roles and accounting for women's failure to develop full personhood. Now, Janice A. Radway's very important 1984 study, which Caroline talked about, it was entitled "The Reading the Romance, Women, Patriarch, and Popular Literature," was one of the first to make a sociological study of women romance readers themselves. And I'm going to skip over a little bit here. As Caroline said, her conclusions were that there were positive benefits as well as negative that women themselves saw. And that although on one level she did see that it really in one sense reinforced the traditional aspect of it, she also saw that that women were using this to, in a sense, also react against the patriarchal structure. Moreover, the very fact that women are claiming, as Caroline said, time for themselves to read romance is a positive step away from the institutional prison that demands denial and sublimation of female identity for the good of home and husband, according to Radway. I think it's interesting that romance scholarship right now, there are a lot of people who don't like Radway because they think that she is too negative about the genre. Whereas I think it's interesting, Caroline, that you picked out some of the positive aspects. With the rise of third wave feminism in the 1990s, a shift began in attitudes toward romance. In her 2001 volume on women and romance, Susan Ostroff Weiser asked the question, does romance weaken or empower women? is it a debilitating illusion, a form of false consciousness, or a universal human need which women should pursue with less shame and greater self-assertion? A very good question. The current trend is moving in the latter direction. Women writers and readers are offering less apology for the pleasure they take in the romance genre. No doubt influenced by postmodern and postcolonial movements away from universal prescriptions for belief or behavior, the emphasis now is on personal agency and personal choice for consenting adults. Among academics, that's really the stance. And women like romance very much, as shown by the astronomical number of novels written and sold every year. Still, there is a good deal of anxiety about the value of popular romance. It is common for defenders of the genre, whether writers, readers, or academics, to begin discussions with the assurance that they too are feminists, professional women, smart bitches with college degrees. Which, in fact, in the 2009 book by Sarah Wendell and Candy Tan, which Amy mentioned, called Beyond Heaving Bosoms, The Smart Bitch's Guide to Romance Novels, which was based on their very popular blog. Their book is hilarious, a very clever and honest look at the pros and cons of the romance genre, and they admit there's a lot of junk out there. It also is full of a lot of foul language, so if you're nervous about that, be warned. They use the F word a lot and other things. One question they ask is, are romance novels really candy-coated porn or vehicles by which we understand our sexual and gender politics? Their answer, as you can see ours is today, is closer to the latter view. And of course they argue this while making fun of all the silliness in romance too. They ask, why do mysteries, thrillers, spy novels, military intrigue stories, and the rest hold a slightly more elevated position in the social ranking of other people's opinions of your reading material than romance does? Are you a woman? Look in your pants. That could be why. They further argue, and of course this is a very interesting aspect of the feminist debate, the whole issue of why is it that a genre that is mostly written by and read by and loved by women is considered the lowest of all of the popular genres. I mean, I think that is a feminist question. Why does this particular genre get that that designation? So they further argue that what is written by women and for women is subversive by nature and inevitably undermines as well as embraces the current social structure. I agree. So, what feminist values can be found in romance novels? Certainly in the best written ones, but in many others that are not as great too. I don't think we need to talk about literary value here. What do romance novels reveal about what women want? I will explore five that I have discovered while reading widely in the genre and subgenres in the past few years. First, romance novels highlight female desire. They care about women's concerns and emotions, about women's identity and personal development. Finding out what women want is a primary concern of these novels. Female desire and pleasure is central in romance novels as a sign of a woman's personhood, her individual wants, which are often at odds with the expectations of the group and her society at large. I believe that this is why female orgasm and sexual pleasure is central in many contemporary and historical romance novels. Studies show that women are often more turned on by words than pictures, which I think your study goes along with too. I don't know if it's true, but it seems to be. I do know that you can't tell whether a woman is faking it in a movie, but you can tell in a book, assuming the narrative voice is reliable. And the whole idea that the women writers want to show that women are having pleasure and that their desire is important, I think is really an interesting and important point here. The written word, the romance novel, for this reason, is an important site for both the depiction and production of female desire, which Caroline's studies reinforces. I need to make a very brief digression here. Not all romances contain explicit sex. Many do not. For example, Georgette Heyer, I don't know if any of you have read her, an English writer of historical romance par excellence,
who lived from 1902 to 1974 and who published very successfully from the 1920s until her death, never depicts overt sexuality in her mostly Regency novels. Though prim and proper on the outside, though, Heyer's novels vibrate with sexual and romantic tension, which I think is important. They are full of interesting heroes and heroines. A romance hero is not exciting or worth his name in any sense if he does not care about female pleasure, which means that he really likes women. For sex, yes, but for so much more. The second feminist quality I find in romance novels is their concern with balancing the physical and emotional, duty and desire, self and other, spirituality and materiality. Romantic love is combined with sexual love, friendship, compatibility, and mutual respect in romance novels. Love may start as a purely physical attraction, but it must go deeper if it is to be real in romances. Love must engage the spiritual and intellectual faculties as well as the sensual. Romance novels acknowledge that money, class, race, and gender are both obstacles to love as well as mechanisms for its fulfillment. Subtle social critique is often part of the background of romance. The third important feminist value in romance novels is the centrality of choice or personal agency. In her important 2003 Natural History of the Romance Novel, Pamela Regis proposes that all romance novels end in freedom. The heroine chooses the hero chooses the heroine. Here she counters one of the most common critiques of the genre I discussed above, that it reinforces women's bondage to traditional marriage and stereotypes of femininity. Underlying this argument is the belief that choice validates women's options and possibilities for freedom and fulfillment. I believe, however, that choice is always in a paradoxical relationship with desire. In matters of love, there is no freedom of choice without the bondage of desire. I have found that women want to be chosen as much as they want to choose. They want to be desired as much as having the full reign to desire. To be in relationship is to be fettered in some way. And this to me is a crucial point, because if you're trying to take the old feminist stance that you've got to get away from fetters, how in the world, or from all the bondage of marriage, how can you have a relationship? And this is really why I think that we have this returning to romance and relationship, because even feminist enlightened women want relationships, and how can you have any relationship without giving up a lot? Because there's always compromise and other things in relationship, which I think these novels show. So the relationship is to be fettered in some way, but the fetters of love create new possibilities for a woman's quest for individual growth and popular romance. Happiness for women is a primary value in romance, and many argue whether or not you need a happily ever after to make it a true romance. This leads to the fourth feminist value in romance novels. Relationship is central to the genre, certainly the romantic relationship. In fact, many define the genre by this central convention. It is a story that focuses primarily on the relationship and union of two people, usually a man and woman, though there is a subgenre of both gay and lesbian romance. However, it is also common for romances today to show the value of family and friends, too. Romantic love should not be bought at the sacrifice of other people. On the other hand, women have the right to claim a life for themselves outside of family duty. Sisterhood, literal and spiritual, is important in many romances. It is common for romance writers today to write a series of novels where a minor character or relative in one becomes the hero or heroine in another, which is sort of the idea that every character matters, right? Which I think is a feminist value. For example, Lisa Kleypas wrote the Wallflower series, where four women who start out as rivals in the London marriage market of the 1850s become friends who make common cause to help each other find husbands, which are a necessary commodity in their time if women are to avoid other unpleasant realities. I think it's interesting with these romance novels where you have a minor character that becomes a major character,
it sort of brings up the fantasy element of this, where everybody ends up having this happily ever after romantic love relationship. And what I like to ask sometimes is, could there possibly be that many good male lovers in one family or one country in the romance series? Now, I know I have limited experience, but I don't know. But it's nice to believe that, you know, all these men could be great lovers. Whether or not the primacy of relationship is a true feminist value is the crux of the debate I'm discussing. Since I accept the fact that sexual romantic love is a basic human need, the real question seems to be the nature of that relationship and whether or not the desire for relationship precludes finding fulfillment in other important ways. The depth and development of characters is the factor that it determines whether romance liberates women. This point leads to my fifth and final feminist value that I will discuss, the need for reciprocity between men and women in every arena, which involves the interplay of independence and dependence. Romance writers and readers today do not like weak heroines. They do not like submissive or manipulative little doormats who give over their identity to men and subordinate their wills in order to get a husband, for better or worse. Women today also don't want the sort of heroines the smart bitches call TSTL, too stupid to live. Heroines can be plain, they can be beautiful. They can be innocent or the soiled dove. They can be anti-heroines or kick-ass alpha heroines. They can be feminine or tomboys, but they cannot be stupid or utterly dependent, or women readers will reject them. Importantly, too, both the hero and heroine must show vulnerability, as well as strength, for romance to work for women today. The struggle toward understanding the other, which involves mutual forgiveness, is a common theme in romance. Reciprocity between men and women in romance does not mean equality of sameness, but the interplay of sexual difference. This is the other controversial aspect of romance for contemporary feminists, who have always worried that difference will lead to gender essentialism and stereotypes. But I think the interplay of sexual difference also accounts for some of the popularity of the genre. Romance as a genre offers a unique setting for the exploration of the way sexual difference instantiates desire at the heart of individual personhood. Because the genre exaggerates male and female characteristics through the archetypes of the romantic hero and heroine, in one of the few contexts where such characters can work narratively, it can play with the limits and possibilities of sexual and gender differences between males and females. It is one of the few places where educated women can freely explore their desire for heterosexual romantic love. Desire in romance is not simply the desire created by sexual difference, but the desire for the other, who is not the self, who is different than the self. Now, I should say this little thing at the end here. I know we're running out of time, but I have my conclusion about a Mormon connection at the end. I think it's interesting that often romantic love stories do deal with people who come from very different places, and like the Tristan and Isolde or Romeo and Juliet, the notion that I say it's no accident that common belief in Mormon culture is that I'm trying to save time now, I'm losing it. It is no accident that myths of romantic love are often about forbidden love between two people from warring factions, such as Romeo and Juliet or the adulterous love of Tristan and Isolde. Such love does not directly advantage society's systems of power. I skipped a little section where I argue that often love contradicts systems of power. It is no accident that a common belief in Mormon culture is that any righteous man and woman can make a successful marriage. This is an idea that springs from Brigham Young, who was more concerned about a successful social order than about individual happiness. So for all the reasons that I've just given, I'm going to do my ending here, which is that I say that I think that romance novels can be beneficial for Mormon feminists. Because I believe that personal desire is highly disruptive of the patriarchal order. I'm not arguing against individual sacrifice for the common good,
We all need to make sacrifices for the community to be healthy and whole. I wish that there were more of this kind of selfless giving in our American nation, which is collapsing from personal greed. But my concern today is for Mormon culture, which I believe is suffocating from the denial of individual desire and choice made on the basis of personal judgment and experience. Rather, all are asked to subordinate their own sense of what is right and desirable to the corporate demand for conformity to a system that feeds corporate power, not individual growth. Choose the right becomes a code for lining up according to a set of prescriptive behaviors that can be judged and punished by the hierarchy. I want to end with my own prescription. For her spiritual well-being, happiness, and personal growth, every Mormon woman should read at least one good romance filled with lots of good sex at least once a year. I believe that the kind of explicit sex found in romance novels like that of Lisa Kleypas, Madeline Hunter, Sherry Thomas, and Ann Stewart can be an important corrective to the system of rigid conformity found in Mormon culture today. It makes me laugh to hear that some think that sex in these novels is soft porn. I have to ask, along with the smart bitches, whether sex that is monogamous, loving, and that usually leads to marriage and children is really pornographic. I believe that the sex in most of the novels I have referenced is in a context that is instructive, enlightening, nurturing, and healing for women. The context validates female sexuality. It says that women are worthwhile and deserving of happiness and love, even if they are not virgins, have been abused, or have been raped. It shows all women as being deserving of happiness and a fulfilling relationship. I am not arguing that all desire is good, but being able to explore one's desires through the imagination is liberating. It gives one the opportunity to test out what is good and true, damaging, or self-destructive. It lets women explore what they need and want in a private space without censure from others. This is one of the primary values of literature and art. By engaging the emotions and the senses, as well as the intellect, literature allows women to experience in a real but vicarious way, the effects of certain attitudes, relationships, traits, beliefs, and behaviors. Such a process is empowering for women, and I would say men too. It allows her to find her heart's desire to speak with an authentic voice, a voice of power and love. Thank you.
So we have about 10 minutes if anybody has questions.
I know that a lot of the romance I've seen that's kind of divided between just kind of romance, erotica, and then I'm assuming pornography is further on. I wonder, do you see a spectrum like that? And have you found maybe definitions of what each of those are? And if so, do you think there's any way to actually get the First Presidency to pay attention to those definitions and use them when making their pronouncements?
Do either of you want to tackle how you define those things?
Well, I think those are really hard definitions. Even in the romance community, they do make a distinction between the romance novels that have a lot of sex versus erotica. And I think the distinction that most of the sort of romance, you know, people who are trying to write about and understand the genre, that they make there is that they would say that in the romance, the sexuality and the explicit sex scenes are, in a sense, they're more integrated into the plot. Mm-hmm. And that they're more a part of in that integration, what it shows is that it's sort of that the sex scene is necessary to move the characters and their relationship along. Whereas in the erotica, it often feels as though the plot is just this sort of thinly veiled sort of frame for the sex scenes. Also, in some of the erotica, there is more of a, they might move more toward showing more extreme sexuality, like threesomes or foursomes, but really the sort of regular romance genres, even though they have the romance, they're not going to have those, but the erotica will.
And in fact, sometimes I've read a few of them, you feel like it's almost required.
Yeah.
Oh, this is erotica, therefore I've got to be really, you know, experimental and shocking and do all of this stuff. But it's interesting. I just read one this summer, all for research, right? where there was very much a plot. It was a very interesting one. It was set in, it was kind of a futuristic novel. But in this one, there were four writers who each had a story and it all connected to this kind of overall world that they had created. But even though they had this sort of experimental sexuality, they all ended with committed relationships mm-hmm. that were mostly kind of, if not monogamous, at least like a threesome that were really committed to each other, right? And I found that was interesting. So I would say that distinction, and I think pornography maybe goes one step further where they're not they don't care about the story or the characters at all. But most of the erotica that I've looked at, they do care about the characters in the story, but they have to kind of highlight the erotica more. Quite frankly, I should never confess this. I think some of the erotica gets really boring.
Yeah.
Because I think that for me, and maybe this again speaks about female desire, at least my female desire, if you have a sex scene where you have built up through really carefully developed relationship and characters to this climax of a sexual scene, it's much more explosive than if you just have, you know, all of these kind of gratuitous sex. It gets boring.
Yeah.
I mean, a novel I'm thinking of is Anne Stewart, The Devil's Waltz, where the sex scene doesn't come until quite late in the book, but she's built it up. It's a fantastic scene, and I think more erotic than a lot of the scenes I've seen in erotica.
I think
I knew I'd confess too much.
So I wrote a review of Magdalene, which is the most recent Joven novel that I referenced, on the Exponent. And one of the points that I made in my review was, in that novel, I call it probably the best portrayal of Mormon culture I've ever encountered in a novel. And one of the reasons I do so is because the sexual relationship between these people is always in service of their character development. It always feels natural as a part of real lives. It's not just gratuitous, we want to make you feel sexual pleasure now, so we're going to throw a sex scene in, you know? And erotica, I think Margaret's really correct that the plot in erotica more often is just kind of a skeletal framework on which to hang sexual encounters. Are there other questions? Yeah.
This is mostly for Caroline. Church discourse emphasizes that women are more spiritual than men, right? They're a little more in touch than men are. And so these desires, or the reading practices, demonstrate that women are firmly rooted in the body. But in the responses that we received, is there an attempt to spiritualize the body then? To say, well, it's not just the body, but it really has a spiritual benefit, so it's not really about the body, it's really about the spirit.
Well, there was some interplay between the two. For instance, when I asked about how reading romance novels affected their spirituality, one woman said, well, a better relationship with my husband equals a better relationship with God. And so there is this conflation of, you know, if I am having a great marriage in all realms, including sexual and physical, then that is going to increase my spirituality, my connection with God. So there was kind of, interplay between the two. It was fluid. It was flexible to some degree.
Okay. And I guess maybe a follow-up question. Did it feel believable, or was it an act of recuperation?
Well, I mean, that was one of my questions. I mean, as I was reading a lot of these responses, how much of this is kind of rationalization and justification? Because 90% of the women that I surveyed are currently consumers of romance novels. So there would be a natural inclination to justify the practice and say, hey, it's not hurting me. And so, yeah, no, it doesn't hurt my spirituality. No, it doesn't hurt my marriage. And so you can see there would be a natural trend to do that. I believe, but I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. I mean, if they say that it is helping their relationship, you know, and if it is empowering them and helping them to feel affirmed in their own desire and their own selves, then I want to absolutely give that to them. But I do think it's good to keep in mind that there, of course, maybe might be some rationalization going on, too.
Go ahead. No, I was going to move on.
I...
one of the points that I made, I think, is relevant here, because I think that the romance, the non-Mormon romance readers and writers often want to connect a spirituality with their sexuality. And so the question is, how can you make sexuality have this, how can it connect to this other part of you so that you're joining the various elements of the self, not separating them? You know, here's my spiritual life over here, and mm-hmm. oh yeah, I also have sex over here. Mm-hmm. It's more, I think that the novels as a whole and the genre is more integrative about the body and the spirit, in a sense.
Which is,
I don't know if you agree, Amy.
I do, and one of the things I love about Mormon doctrine, and why I continue to associate myself with it, one of the big reasons is that Mormon doctrine recognizes the central importance of our bodies. And when you really delve into how we talk in Mormon doctrine about the body and the spirit, now this doesn't translate to what happens in church all the time. Often it doesn't show up at all. The opposite does. But when you really look at it, the body and the spirit, in order for a soul to exist, the body and the spirit both have to be present. And that's one of the, I think, the most beautiful aspects of Mormon doctrine. And what these novels so often do is acknowledge that reality. Right, so for the heroes that I was talking about, they have these sexually like promiscuous pasts. What brings about their evolution, right, and their new existence is the unification of sex with emotion, right, of recognizing emotional vulnerability, right, becoming, as Margaret pointed out, fettered in relationship to another human being. For the female characters, so often it becomes kind of the opposite. Evolution, right? She has a more highly developed relationship existence because she exists in family or with friendships, and it's the exposure to sex that then connects her more closely to her body. So I think that these books really do celebrate that union.
Yeah. How can my sexual self be in harmony with my spiritual self, in a sense, is the question.
Another question?
Maybe it's kind of a weird question. I'm trying to think if it was somebody here or in the previous meeting, but we were talking about how something about how we've come so far, like in women's rights movements, and how we need to kind of recreate the way men exist, you know, the kind of the prototype for what a man can be,
mm-hmm.
In order for things to progress. And I'm wondering, I don't even know if we can, I don't know, maybe this is ridiculous, if there's this way, you know, where, you know, a romance novel can connect, you know, maybe the spirit and the body, and it can affirm female pleasure, but it can also affirm, you know, whole people and whole
right.
relationships. I'm wondering if there is, like, something that men could have, because I feel like pornography and kind of a culture of pornography reinforces this idea of men dominating and raping
mm-hmm.
and taking what they want, and I'm wondering if there's something that, if there's, like, something like that for men,
a male
that's
equivalent?
Even a ridiculous question.
I mean, not. I don't think. I think it's a really good question.
One thing that pops into my mind is the recent like extreme popularity of bromances. So in film, that I mean, there really have been a lot more recent buddy films. You know, the downside of that is they do tend to use really negative stereotypes about men in order to generate humor. But I do see that trend as being. Kind of moving in that direction of emphasizing the importance of relationship rather than kind of isolation. I don't know if you guys have...
For me, the question would be, why don't men, or do men, write books about relationship? I mean, to me, that's the interesting thing that women are doing. They're writing about that women want to read about relationship. So the question is, why don't men want to read about relationship or about romantic love? Do they have a need for it? Do they have a desire for it? Should they? Would it help men?
Yeah, I don't know.
If they could, you know. I did read a recent book called Beginner's Greek. It was published a couple of years ago. I'm always picking up books that are on the summer reading in the Marriott Library. And I said, Beginner's Greek.
It's not about Greek, though. But it's a romance written by a man, and it's kind of in some ways more realistic, but it has a really happily ever after ending. I would categorize it as romance, and my response was, yay, a man writing a romance.
Yeah.
And he likes women, and they're just not kind of the subplot, but it's the plot. Mm-hmm. I saw that as very positive.
That calls to mind Jennifer Kruse, who's one of my favorite contemporary romance authors, has collaborated with a guy named Bob Mayer on a handful of romance novels. And you can definitely see that there's this masculine influence on the storylines, but they are romance novels, you know? And so those are very interesting collaborations. Yeah, Janice.
I just wanted to say, couldn't men read romances too? Would there be something wrong with that? I have a son who is an astrophysicist. He loves romance novels. So you could read romance novels, and if you're embarrassed by the cover, you can get your Kindle.
That's right. I mean, this actually points to another trend in women's literature more generally. I mean, I date online. I'm single. I've been doing online dating since 2004. And so I've looked at a lot of men's profiles in online dating sites. I could probably count on my two hands in the last 8 years how many men I've seen who have listed female authors in their lists of favorite books. And these are men that I like and respect sometimes. I mean, one of my very best friends from grad school, no female authors. He has no female author he likes to read. And I mean, this is a very common trend in readership and consumption. The men very rarely go out of their way to read books by women authors. They often castigate them. They don't want anything to do with Austen or Bronte. You know, they're over the top, they're overly emotional, they're overwrought. You know, like anything you could think of, it's probably been said about a woman author.
Well, you know, and I think it even goes to an earlier trend of reading in children, that it's very common that girls will read stories with boy heroes, boys will not read stories with girl heroes. And someone asked J.K. Rowling about this, why did you make your main character a boy? And, you know, I mean, I don't think it was a simple answer. She's an author. She had a lot of reasons. But she said one reason was that she wanted to appeal to boys as much as girls.
Yeah.
And that if she had it as a female heroine, a heroine, you would not have boy readers. And so I think this question of why, you know, why won't men participate in this sort of female world? Why is it seen as somehow degrading?
Aren't men reading The Hunger Games just as avidly as women, though?
That's a new trend.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of violence.
There's a lot of violence.
Yeah. That. I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, part of the problem also is that, I mean, as I pointed out, our culture, male gender roles in our culture, are a lot of men feel like they're under attack. You know, feminism and the changes that have resulted from second wave and third wave feminism are seen as a threat. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen parents of small boys be horrified by the fact that their child wants to play with a doll. You know, I mean, there are still really powerful prescriptions about male gender roles in our society, and not just in the Mormon Church. Yeah.
I just have one thing I wanted to add to that. I mean, I think part of the reason is, too, I mean, men have monogamous urges, too, but obviously women have stronger monogamous urges and settle down and nest. Men always kind of have that urge to have multiple partners as well, like polyamorous kind of relationships, too. Mm-hmm. So that could be kind of stifling, whereas, you know, they may want to be monogamous and they have the happily ever after, but those urges to be polyamorous, again, may come back. And, you know, how to deal with that, or where's the right and wrong with that could be another issue.
You know, that's an interesting question, one that Margaret brought up at one point about the differing, like, what are the differences between male and female, like, desire and how they get manifest. And, you know, it's a challenging question. I mean, I understand the trends. I don't always believe that they're true of every man.
Well, again, I love this idea of Jennifer Kruse and this man writing a romance together. I think that if there could be more male-female discourse about it, that would be a really positive move forward.
Yeah, we're all out of time.
We're out of time, but thank you
so much
for your attention.
Thank you.